Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Ever since I started doing research again on Rhodesia at the end of 2018, and of course all of Southern Africa, and lately I've been doing even more research on the matter, there are various things that have come up that I was sitting and pondering. Some are historical problems, like who was a traitor and who wasn't. And then there are also issues that relate to the future. And this video deals with both sets of issues. In the one case, I'm going to look at the past, and then I'm going to look at the past and how the past can be a guide to the future. Napoleon said that you will find inspiration in history, and that is so true. And for whites, history is the place to find inspiration. History is filled with all kinds of things. And when people engage in warfare, and when whites engage in risks, then of course there are lots of disputes that come out of it, etc. But the reality is that when whites engage in risks, they do dangerous things, they take all kinds of risks, people get killed, they try various actions, it might work or it might not work, then this results in lots of discussion, lots of controversy, etc. And it's all actually healthy and good, really. But I want to look at some of these issues, especially with what we can learn from the Rhodesian Rebellion and how it applies to the future. Now, this guy that you see here, the Right Honourable Ian Smith, he was the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, and he was the guy who pushed Rhodesia down a path that led to the war and eventually led to the handover of power to blacks. Now, there are people who've said that Ian Smith is a traitor, and they've said so on the basis of the fact that eventually Rhodesia went down. And there are even Rhodesians who nowadays, even guys who are in the military, even officers, even senior people who now have all kinds of doubts about what Rhodesia did and whether in fact we should have taken the path that we took. And so Ian Smith, like Adolf Hitler, like Mussolini, like anybody else who took a risk, Ian Smith comes under a lot of scrutiny. When I look at some of the issues that people like Campbell and others raise about Rhodesia, and when I also read what some Rhodesians write about whites who came from other countries to fight in Rhodesia, I can see that there is a certain amount of unity and a certain amount of goodwill as whites try to help whites. However, there are also tricky things that are not obvious to the people outside Rhodesia, to people who come from outside Rhodesia to assist the whites in Rhodesia. It becomes quite a tricky problem. And this pertains to all things that whites do. And there are some of these topics that I'll touch on another day. In this particular video, I want to discuss UDI, the rebellion, because this is critical and it's also useful for the future. Just as there is this topic of secession, the topic of secession is key here in South Africa, people are talking about secession quite a bit, and I like it. I love it. The idea of a Volkstaat being Afrikaans for ethnostate. These things are very important. And when I look at UDI, which Rhodesia declared, now what is UDI, you might say? UDI was Unilateral Declaration of Independence. This was a rebellion. And I want to discuss this because this is similar to secession. It's just a more hardcore approach, perhaps, in that there aren't certain legal things. The whites just decided that we're going to do this and we don't care what the others say and we're going to go with this. So if you look on this newspaper headline in the Rhodesia Herald, this is from 1965. This is when Rhodesia rebelled against Britain. So it says, Parliament may now amend Constitution's entrenched provisions. And then right down here you see something. It says, Wilson calls UDI an illegal act. Now, secession, these days, there is a procedure for secession that countries to be are allowed to have. And South Africa apparently also has rules for secession sitting in our constitution. And there are people trying to gather together enough votes so that we can carry out some kind of secession. But in the case of Rhodesia, how do you do things if you don't have those kinds of provisions? And the Rhodesian situation was kind of different because Rhodesia was a British colony that had been self-governing. The British had allowed Rhodesia to govern itself since 1923. So now you've got this situation 42 years later where the whites have been ruling this British colony by themselves for 42 years while liaising with Britain, but it is understood that the whites are in charge of the colony and the whites are ruling the blacks. And now these whites are rebelling against Britain. And these whites already governing the country have total control of the military, total control of everything, the police, the parliament, the everything. And so then they say, well, we are the ruling power in this country. We control all the various parts of this country and all the mechanisms. We control the army, the air force, the police. And we're going to turn our backs on Britain. So they don't have to actually seize power. They already have power. They've had it for 42 years. So they've got all the mechanisms for power in their hands. And they say, okay, we're going to go against Britain. Now, of course, the reason why they went against Britain was because Britain at this point had begun dumping its entire empire. Britain in 1960 went and dumped its entire empire. And since it controlled about a third of Africa, Britain had made the decision that all the British territories in Africa will be handed over to the blacks. Now, of course, Jewish communism has been at work, and the Soviets especially and the Chinese have been busy with the blacks. Just as the Soviets and the KGB have been busy in Asia, in South America, in Latin America, at this time the KGB has been busy all across the world with non-whites, telling them to rebel against the European empires. But at the top of the list is the British Empire. So the reason for rebellion is that the handful of whites who control Rhodesia and who are outnumbered by the blacks, I think at the time of UDI it was probably outnumbered 12 to 1, but later to be outnumbered 24 to 1. In fact, it might already even have been 20 to 1 at the time of rebellion. Very close to that population ratio. So what you have is you've got a white minority who are basically the elite and in charge of everything. And they're told they must hand over power to the majority of blacks. And they say, no, we're not going to do it. And then they say things like, we're not against the blacks, but we want proper rule. They used to say things like, we want responsible government. And then they also said things like, we're fighting communism, which is true. But the bottom line is that whites don't trust blacks, and therefore whites don't want to hand over power. So this is UDI. And Britain is saying to everybody, hand over to the blacks, you got to do it. South Africa, interestingly enough, and that's another topic, South Africa manages to bypass this problem because they do something else. South Africa beats Rhodesia to the punch by becoming a republic. Now, in South Africa, there are people who talk about the South African situation, and they say that doing that was a treasonous act, and it led to all kinds of problems. That's junk. And I'll come back to the issue of South Africa and Rhodesia, and why what South Africa did was much better. But South Africa had much more power and was in a different situation. South Africa was like Canada. It was a dominion, whereas Rhodesia was still a colony. So legally, Rhodesia's position in the pecking order in the British Empire was much lower, whereas South Africa was much bigger, more powerful, and better entrenched, and had a higher legal status. So there are other ifs and buts to do with Rhodesia that I'm not going to go into, where the whites talk about how the British promised them independence. The British had promised to the whites independence in Rhodesia at a point. But then, of course, the British later changed their mind. So all of these different things come into play, and at a point the whites say, hey, we don't agree with the British, and we're not going to hand over to the blacks. We don't trust the blacks. The blacks aren't going to rule the country properly, etc., etc. So they now engage in this thing called Unilateral Declaration of Independence, UDI, and it's illegal. And the last rebellion that I know of that was illegal in the British Empire were the Irish, I think in 1916. So this move to doing UDI, this is outright illegal action against Britain. Whites, a small population of whites, 250,000 whites, ruling about 4 million or 4.5 million blacks at the time, later to become 6.5 million blacks, and these whites are rebelling against Britain. So it's illegal. What they're doing is illegal. And that's critical here, because that is what I want to discuss here. So here you can see Ian Smith. And that RF there is the Rhodesian Front. And that is the sort of conservative right-wing party of Rhodesia. Ian Smith comes to power, and he comes to power, I think, in about 1964. His rise to power is quite quick, and it's kind of unexpected, and he replaces somebody else. And here you can see, just like you got people saying America first now, there you can see Rhodesia first. So anyway, So this is the Rhodesian Front, and that is the political party that rebelled against Britain, with Ian Smith as the leader. So here is Ian Smith. There is the coat of arms of Rhodesia. And it is this act by Ian Smith of rebellion that now causes other people to later say, well, we ended up with sanctions, we ended up with the world against us, we ended up in a war, we lost the war, we lost our power, maybe we shouldn't have done it. So this is similar stuff to Hitler and Mussolini and anybody else who does anything that's high risk, is that if it fails, if it works, everyone's like, yay, yay, we did it, we're heroes, etc. But when it fails, then people say, okay, well, maybe the leader was an idiot, maybe the leader was a traitor. And a lot of people have pointed at Ian Smith, especially in recent times, and they've called him a traitor. And even people who were close to Ian Smith and knew him personally and knew him well, whom I have spoken to, have said to me that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have done this, etc. And I say, but hold on, you know, are you saying that Smith did the wrong thing? You know, why are you having all these doubts now? And I want to tackle this topic for two reasons. The first one is historical, because I want to explain to you and show you that Smith by no means was a traitor, that the traitor argument doesn't work, doesn't fly. And then secondly, I want to discuss white states in the future, ethno-states in the future, secession in the future. Because what happened to Rhodesia can and probably will happen to anybody else who tries to make a move. Any whites who try to make a move politically could end up in the same situation as Rhodesia, even if they're not a colony, nobody's a colony. But the moment that you break away and you try to do a whites-only thing, you could end up in a Rhodesia situation. And that holds true in the United States, if people try to secede over there. In fact, look at what happened with secession in 1863. In the 1860s in the United States. How did that secession go? And that secession was legal. That secession was legal. The South didn't break any rules. And what happened? A war. Because the Union decided that they don't care about the fact that this is legal. They're going to force the Southern states back into the Union. So you have a war waged illegally in order to unify the country again. So I believe in secession, and I'm all for secession, especially in South Africa. But I don't think that people are just going to be able to get away with it. I have told people that I'm convinced that if whites try to create a whites-only country, especially in Africa, we're asking for trouble. Make no mistake, I'm 110% in favor of this. I want this, and I believe in this. And I believe that we need to do a UDI in South Africa in the future. And I definitely want to be involved in that. But I just want to point out the risks. Because people who think that you're going to make a political move and whites are going to gain power and it's going to go unchallenged militarily, they don't know what they're in for. And this is also where I want to show you that Ian Smith was no fool. And nobody has pointed out what I'm about to point out to you. And it is this, that Ian Smith, by declaring UDI, and of course the whole Rhodesian Parliament and everything, everybody voted on this, they went through their procedures, they voted on it, everybody stood together, but he was the leader. And I want to show you that this guy, was way more cunning than you think. And the Rhodesians had some aces up their sleeves. These people pulled off quite a few feats. And here is the question that I'm going to raise to you. And it's a question that hit me about 18 months ago when I first started looking at this stuff. And the question was, if this is illegal and Rhodesia is rebelling against Britain, like the Americans rebelled against Britain, like 1776, what happened to America in 1776 when they rebelled against Britain? Britain came and the British army was there killing whites in America. So how come in 1776 the British come and they kill Americans, and I think the same is true for 1916 with the Irish, but why did Britain not invade Rhodesia? Why didn't Britain attack and invade Rhodesia? Because it had every right to do so. And that is a mystery of Rhodesia that nobody ever discusses. And nobody ever raises it. And I want to show you a few things in this regard. In this little video that you're going to see, here's a short video from 1960. So this is 5 years before UDI. Here is the Queen coming to visit Rhodesia. And notice how for such a small country of maybe 250,000 whites or 200,000 whites at that time, how 60,000 turn out to meet the Queen and the Queen Mother, and how good relations are between the colony of Rhodesia and the Brits.
This is Movietone, Jeffrey Sumner reporting. London Airport and the start of another royal tour. The Queen was there to see her mother off on a 6,000-mile flight by BOAC Britannia to Salisbury. Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother's tour of the Rhodesias and Nyasaland was planned to last 3 weeks. And perhaps the most notable engagement of her visit would be the official opening of the great Kariba Dam. In view of recent violence in the Copperbelt area of northern Rhodesia, special precautions are being taken, of course. But no changes in the program of the tour had as yet been announced. All good wishes went with the royal traveller for a successful and enjoyable trip. Salisbury's wet weather had given way to brilliant sunshine in time for the Queen Mother's arrival. The Governor-General, Lord Dalhousie, led the official welcome and made the presentations to Her Majesty. The Guard of Honour was found by the 1st Battalion, the Royal Rhodesia Regiment. A big, popular welcome was in store on the drive from the airport to the federal capital. Apart from the ceremonial escort, troops and police were conspicuous by their absence. Salisbury, in fact, had turned out in full force to give the Queen Mother the friendliest of greetings all the way. Crowds in the streets were estimated to number 60,000, probably the biggest ever seen here. The people had waited hours just to see her drive past. It was an auspicious beginning to the tour, with everyone cheering the royal visitor as she now stopped for the civic reception at the city centre. Built by...
Now take a look at this clip from the time when Ian Smith declared UDI, and look at the crisis that it created in Britain. Because here is one of the British colonies openly rebelling against Britain. And it's illegal. And you'll hear them say that as far as the law goes, Ian Smith is no longer in power. By declaring UDI, the British government no longer recognizes Ian Smith as a valid leader. He's carried out a criminal action, and Rhodesia itself is a criminal state. And what will follow will be sanctions, but there's no talk of military invasion. Eventually, Britain goes to the United Nations, and Britain asks the United Nations and the whole world to put sanctions on their colony that's rebelled against them. So Britain actually asks the rest of the world to engage in sanctions against Rhodesia. But by international law, Rhodesia belongs to Britain. And Rhodesian territory is British territory. And the British have got jurisdiction over every inch of Rhodesia, legally speaking. Everybody in the world agrees with that. And the British are absolutely outraged by it. Harold Wilson was from the Labour Party, so he's a kind of a semi-communist. The Labour people were full of communists. But that's not the main issue here. Later on, when the Conservatives came under Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, the good, strong British leader, she was actually worse than Wilson. So we won't go down that path of whether it was Labour versus Conservatives who were the issue. At the end of the day, when this thing wound up eventually, it didn't matter. Though, of course, in Rhodesia, we hated Wilson. We hated him. But in reality, he didn't do that much that was that bad. But the key thing is the military stuff. So watch this little piece of film footage, because I've got more to tell you.
There was a deceptive calm in Salisbury, capital of Rhodesia, on the day of UDI, the Declaration of Independence. Something had happened that was long expected, and the first reaction in business quarters, as well as among the ordinary people, was one of relief. The realists knew that the reckoning would come later. Hurriedly to number 10 came opposition leader Edward Heath and the Liberal leader Joe Grimmon. They and most of their followers agreed that Mr. Wilson's attitude was the only one possible. The Foreign Minister Stewart, the Minister of Defence Dennis Healey, and all other members of the government backed the Prime Minister to the hilt. Paymaster General George Wigg, Commonwealth Relations Secretary Arthur Bottomley had accompanied the Premier to Rhodesia, and now Mr. Wilson was going to the House of Commons. He had a sad but necessary duty to perform, to declare UDI illegal. Outside Rhodesia House in the Strand, there were some hostile demonstrations during the day. Officials among themselves discussed the likely effects of the sanctions to be imposed by the British government. If any members of the public had clung to the belief that both sides were bluffing, they knew the stern truth now. Of tobacco, Rhodesia's greatest export, Britain will import no more until legal government is restored out there. For everybody in the gigantic industry, the moment of truth may not be now, but cannot be long postponed. Ian Smith may have been the prisoner of extremists,
Legally, he is no longer in office. He disregarded Harold Wilson's sage advice. Prime Minister, think again.
Now, there are Rhodesians who will tell you that the fight for Rhodesia was not racial. You will find that there are even Americans who were in Rhodesia, who fought there, who later will say that no, the fight in Rhodesia was not about race. However, the Soviet Union and China didn't have a problem with race. They were using the race card to the maximum. And their goal was to fund and arm black movements to fight against whites to get majority rule. Because now apparently majority rule, one man, one vote, is what all these blacks need. But of course, the world is actually much more cynical than you realize. And one of the things that many, many whites make a mistake in, I notice this over and over again. There are whites in South Africa, whites everywhere, who actually believe that wars are fought for moral and ethical reasons. And this is just rubbish, man. If you really study military history and you really study real history, you will find that war has got nothing to do with moral and ethical questions. The moral and ethical questions are brought along as the propaganda to justify the war. The war is always, 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 without exception, the war is always about power. A war is always about power. And if not direct rule, then it's about economic power. But it's about power. However, so many whites think that wars are fought for ethical and moral reasons. And that is because every government of every country, especially the English and the Americans, phrase all their military affairs using these wonderful ethical, moral sounding phrases. So people think that the army is going to kill other people because it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. No, it's not. It's about power. So when you get to the Russians and the Chinese pushing majority rule and black rule and saying that blacks should rule because they outnumber the whites, one man, one vote, equality, it's the right thing to do, it's the moral thing to do. That's just hogwash, man. The Russians aren't black themselves. The Russians who thought up the strategy are white men sitting in Russia, man. They are doing this because this is a tactic that's going to work for their country. They saw the destruction of the European empires as a way of strengthening Russian power. The Soviet Union was out to conquer the world. Well, not just the Soviet Union, but all of communism, all of Jewish communism was out to conquer the world. And they just saw these blacks vastly outnumbering the whites. They saw these as countries that are going to be easily overthrown. These countries are going to be easily overthrown, the whites are going to be easily defeated, and here they're going to have a whole bunch of retarded blacks who are going to run a country, do whatever they want them to do, and they can cite the fake reason that it was all about morality and good and evil and all that kind of junk. It's not. Many nations, most nations in fact, maybe even all nations, are cynical. And that includes the United States itself, Britain itself. There are whites who run these countries who are actually cynical. They've got an agenda that's going to work for them. And whatever they do, they will come up and stand in front of the cameras and say, oh, we're doing it because it's for the good of this and for the good of that. And, you know, we need to fight slavery and we need to fight this and people need an opportunity and all such junk. And they're saying it because there are other deals that they've got going. There are other economic factors driving them. The reality is, whatever governments are doing, they do it for a reason. And the reason is not the moral, ethical, highfalutin sounding reason that they put out in public. It's not that reason. That's just the rubbish that they use to get everyone excited that we need to do a good thing and we got to go over there to kill those people and we're killing them for the right reason. And people truly believe, oh, we fought Nazism, we were fighting against evil. No, you weren't. You were fighting against the Germans because it had to do with power, because it had to do with the British not liking the rise of Germany, a brand new united state inside Europe, where all these different little Germanic countries had been cobbled together and unified by Bismarck, and now this united Germany is a brand new massive power in Europe. And France doesn't like it, Britain doesn't like it. That's what the real issue is. They need to go and smash that country because that country is a threat to them. But they always phrase it in terms of good and evil. Oh, you see, we didn't want to go and kill those people, but we had to because it's the right thing to do. All rubbish and junk. It has to do with power, and all of warfare has to do with power. They don't go and send troops into places to kill people just because somebody's feeling kind and generous. The reality is that the world, including the United States, operates in a very cynical way. And the Russians are just as cynical, the Chinese are just as cynical, everybody is cynical. The fact of the matter was that the Russians and the Chinese were sponsoring black movements in Africa, and these black movements had as their goal the overthrow of white power. The power of the Portuguese, the power of the Rhodesians, the power of the South Africans, the power of the Southwest Africans. Yes, that was the goal. And then they say, oh, well, you see, the minority whites, they're evil, they shouldn't be in charge, they shouldn't be ruling. The reality is that those countries outside of Africa as well, that includes the Soviet Union, that includes the Americans, the British, because they do not live in Africa, they don't care about the long-term benefits for Africa. Unlike the whites who live in Africa. And this is true for all whites who live in all white countries. Is that you are concerned about your country because that is where you live. Now, in the case of the whites of Southern Africa, the whites are living here and they don't live in Britain, and all their assets and their lives are here, and they're not going to just give it up. So they turn to fight for it. And this is normal in history. This is totally normal in history, that any kind of group that has got power never gives up the power. They never give it up without a fight. And so that is all that was happening, is the Russians and the Chinese are coming to the blacks, are saying, listen, you can be in charge, you can be the president, you do this, and we'll give you guns, you kill the whites, you make communism the thing, and we'll be your buddies, and by the way, we want to buy those and those and those minerals from you, and anytime you need guns, you can get it from us. That is how it really worked. And it's absolutely like that for all the countries of Southern Africa. The Russians don't give a shit as to whether the blacks can actually function under communism. The Russians don't give a shit as to whether the blacks are able to keep the country together. They just want to put them in power and they'll assist them to stay in power so that those blacks are their puppets in Africa. And that is the be-all and the end-all of this thing. So all that you've got are the Russians and the Chinese, this Jewish communism coming and trying to use the black masses as a means to overthrow the whites. It's no more complex than that. Yet every lying politician from all these countries outside Africa, whether it's the Russians or the British or whoever, they're all talking in these highfalutin sounding terms as if they're reading out of a Bible, and they're saying, well, you see, this is evil and that is good and that's why you need to do this. They don't give a flying fuck as to whether the country will go down the tubes when the blacks are running it, because they don't live there. All they're interested in is striking a deal with the blacks who are going to rule the country. It's as simple as that. Politics is very ruthless. It's actually always been ruthless, even among whites, even in ancient times. Maybe the Romans are among the only whites who really did think in more moral terms than others. But most of the time, this wasn't the case. Things operated on hard and fast, ruthless principles. And it's so even today. The greatest competition in the world is between nation states. It's like that even right now. It's just that it's not that intense in the Western world at this point in time that people are bombing each other. But it is ruthless. So anyway, the point I want to get to is that you're going to find Rhodesians are very, very good at getting away from the racial issue, especially these days. Rhodesians are able to very easily and quickly dispel the notion that there was a racial involvement in this at all. They will say, no, you know, the whites didn't set out to oppress the blacks, we cared about everybody. It is true, we did look on the blacks as our children and that they are to be looked after. And we know that they're idiots, we know they are idiots, and we know we have to look after them or else they will die. This is totally true. That aspect of Rhodesia was true. And it's not just Rhodesia. The Portuguese were like this, the South Africans were like this, all whites in Southern Africa were like this. They did not set out to kill the blacks because they were black. They looked on the blacks as an asset in the country, mostly an economic asset. They looked on the blacks as an asset in the country, cheap labor. The real benefit was cheap labor. And these blacks are therefore valuable citizens because we're getting cheap labor out of them and they allow us to do a lot. So you've got 200,000 whites, and this is in 1965, you've got 200,000 whites ruling about 3.5 million blacks. Later it's 250,000 whites ruling about 6 million blacks because their population is growing at a massive rate thanks to good governance, white leadership, etc., etc. So whites are good at hiding the notion that race was the issue, but race was the issue. However, the fact that the blacks were adopting communism and that the communists were sponsoring them, this just made black rule even more objectionable. So, yes, the one compounded the other. And so, yes, just telling the whites and just saying we're fighting communism, it works. And lots of whites do believe that they should be fighting communism. But the truth of the matter is that on the Russian side, they're not worried about that. they are feeling confident, and the Soviets want racial conflict. This is a race war, and it is about black versus white. So you find these whites of Rhodesia and later also South Africa, as they are ducking and diving, they are constantly trying to pretend that they're not racists. That even if they're not that sophisticated, they do believe that their people are the better people. They do want their people to rule. They do want their people to have a good life. They are more concerned about their own kind. So you've got a race war, but then the race war can also be reinterpreted as capitalism versus communism. And you can pull that off to quite a large extent, and it will fly. You'll be able to convince a lot of people about it. Among the things that Rhodesians have said to me are things like, well, we had all these blacks who fought for us, and they fought well for us. So how can you say that this was racial? And there were lots of units that were whites only units. They were whites only right until the day that black rule came. Examples of whites only units is the RLI, the Rhodesian Light Infantry, totally white right to the last day of its existence. There is the SAS, the Special Air Services, an elite unit, totally white, right throughout the war, right to the last day of the war. Yet these very same Rhodesians who were in those whites-only units, and even the commanders thereof will tell you, no, this wasn't a racial conflict. Who are they kidding? And then go to the other side and go and look at the blacks. How many whites were on the black side? And the answer is, the only whites that you found on the black side were either the Soviets or whatever Jews, mostly South African Jews, floating around like Joe Slovo, etc. You won't find other whites on the other side. Like I say, a handful. The odd idiot Englishman or the odd idiot Afrikaner who went to go and help the blacks. But on the whole, these conflicts were white versus black. The fact that the whites made up like 80% of the army and the blacks on their own side made up 99% of their own army. In fact, all the forces that we met in battle were only blacks, except for the odd occasion when we ran into Russians and Chinese and killed them, or Cubans. But Rhodesians and even South Africans try to duck and dive around this racial issue, and I regard it as nonsense. We've got to grow up and start being adults about it and start looking at things and saying, this is this and that is that, and for goodness sake, this is what was the driving force. And it's almost amazing that I have to actually spend all this time making this argument. But recently I spoke to a Rhodesian colonel, and we had exactly this discussion about blacks and whites and blah, blah, blah. And no, it wasn't about race. Oh, good God. What a load of nonsense. It's as if people are kidding themselves. And Rhodesians do another thing. They turn around and say, well, we didn't have apartheid like the whites of South Africa. But for all intents and purposes, if you go and you look at the laws, you'll see that Rhodesia was a racially divided state. That there were areas where blacks lived and areas where whites lived. That whites did not live in black townships and blacks did not come and live in white suburbs. Those things only changed in the last year or two of the war. Only then were blacks allowed to come and live in the suburbs where we lived. But you'll find that there's this ducking and diving and ducking and diving about race, and it's highly irritating for me. So what I want to show you is a short clip from Ian Smith himself, And also, just notice in the various clips that you're going to hear him speak. You're going to hear him talk. You're going to see his audience. His audience is totally white. Look at what he says. Who the hell are these people kidding? They are whites and they want to retain control of the country for themselves because they see themselves as superior. They see the blacks as idiots and they want to control their future. So in this little clip that you're about to see, you're going to hear Ian Smith saying something that the liberals went to town on for years afterwards. He went and he said that there was not going to be black majority rule in Rhodesia for 1,000 years. 1,000 years. That's what Ian Smith said. So listen to it. You'll hear it right out of his own mouth.
I don't believe in black majority rule ever in Rhodesia. Not in 1,000 years.
Now, I just want to stay a bit on the race issue with Ian Smith, because you've heard him say, no black majority rule in 1,000 years. Now we're jumping forward maybe 12 or more years into the future. And a journalist corners Ian Smith over that same comment. And so it's well over 10 or more years later, and he asks Smith, what does he have to say about that comment? And you'll hear Smith say an interesting thing. He says that it was a fair comment and that if black majority rule comes to Rhodesia, that our policy would have failed. In other words, in a very nice and diplomatic way, he's saying that he regards it as a failure that blacks are going to rule the country. So listen to this and you'll hear it out of his own mouth. And I wanted to use these video clips just to show you that Ian Smith, the leader, said these things. It came out of his own mouth. And Rhodesians must not try to pretend that this is not so. And you'll see other film footage that if you look at it carefully, you'll see you've got a bunch of white racists here. People who, even if they are not overtly racist, they definitely do not believe that blacks are our equals. And they definitely do not want to be ruled by blacks.
Once upon a time, Prime Minister, you said you would never see black rule in this country in your lifetime. Do you still stand by that?
Yes, I believe that that was a fair comment, and I think that if we ever got to a stage of having black rule, then I think our policy would have failed.
Now, in this clip that you're going to see, this is from 1964. This is from a year before UDI. And here you're going to see Ian Smith talking to an audience. And look carefully in the audience. You're not going to see a single black face. Not one black person is sitting there. All of those faces are whites. White men and white women. And listen to him talking about civilization and the future. And that they don't just want civilization to continue for 100 years, they want it to continue for always. And then he goes on to say that what this means is independence. Independence from Britain. And look at how these whites jump up and applaud what he's saying. It's a white man speaking to a white audience. Look at their reactions. So don't come and tell me that this isn't racial. There you can see it. Not one black face is in that audience.
Oh, By 1964, independence under black rule had been conceded for all Britain's African colonies, except one. In southern Rhodesia, 200,000 white settlers still ruled the colony's 3 million blacks and were determined to keep it that way. To protect their lifestyle, the most luxurious in Africa, they chose a new prime minister with instructions to fight any British move which threatened white control.
The era of civilized control in southern Rhodesia isn't estimated in a period of 2 years, as some people have tried to. We don't even stretch the era of civilization in southern Rhodesia to 100 years. As far as we are concerned, it has got to be for all time. And then, of course, ladies and gentlemen, that means only one thing: independence.
I went.
In this bit of film footage, Ian Smith makes a quiet joke, and he talks about the debate around UDI and what a crazy thing it is, what a wild thing it is, and can only a few 100,000 whites stand up against Britain and the world, and that it's really a crazy idea. And notice how the audience is enjoying it. They get the joke. And you are basically seeing some whites enjoying a bit of white power and a bit of white victory. They've stuck their finger in the face of Britain and the world, and they're having a good laugh. They've done a bold and dangerous thing, and they're still alive, and things are still working. So just a little bit of an idea of the feeling of those times in the 1960s. At this time, I was a baby. I was unaware of all of these things.
There were many, many, many people who said, what a fantastic thing, what a ridiculous thing, what a stupid thing to think that a few 100,000 people like this can defy not only Britain, but really the United Nations and the rest of the world and get away with it. What a nerve. Who do they think they are? Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we've actually won. We have won.
In this longer piece of film footage, you're going to see a bunch of things, and I'm just going to address a couple of them. In the first one, you're going to see Sir Arthur Snelling, and he talks about his time when he went to visit the Rhodesians and to speak to Ian Smith and his people. And basically, these are hard-headed whites who aren't interested in messages and information that doesn't work for them. It drives this guy crazy. And it's quite funny, actually, the hard-headedness of these whites. But you know what? This is good. And whites in the future need to learn to be like this. And of course, this is minor compared to the kinds of struggles of Hitler, the Confederates, etc. Whites have to learn to dig in their heels. We've got to be like this and much tougher in the future. We've got to be like this, got to be like Hitler, got to be firm like this, and much tougher in the future. It's going to be the only way to survive. Now we're going to return to the other topic, which is the danger part of it. Britain invading Rhodesia. And in here, I'd like you to listen very carefully and observe very carefully, because there are a bunch of things in this 6-minute piece of film footage. Interestingly enough, one fellow that you're going to see here is actually a very critical guy who plays a big role in the war. And in all my years of studying Rhodesian stuff, I've never come across film footage where he actually speaks. And his name is Ken Flower. And Ken Flower is the guy who's in charge of the CIO, the Central Intelligence Organization. This is our top spy. He used to be a policeman, and he's a pretty cunning fellow, this guy. In the war, there were other issues that arose regarding him. There are even whites who called him a traitor, but it appears to me that he wasn't an actual traitor, though there was a traitor in his department, but it wasn't him. There was a British spy, but he was probably the second in charge, whereas Ken Flower is in charge of the CIO during all the time. Anyway, you'll get to see Ken Flower, and I'm just mentioning it's the first time ever that I've managed to get any film footage of Ken Flower. But after that, the real issue is the seizure of power and the way the whites go about it. The seizure of power, along with the great danger that Britain is going to invade us. Britain can destroy us. Now just think back, for example, to the Falklands War in 1982, when the Argentinians invaded the British Falkland Islands there off the coast of South America. How did the British react to the invasion of the Falkland Islands? The British put together a carrier fleet and submarines and aircraft and troops, and they went there and they fought the Argentinians and they smashed them and they drove them out in 1982. That could easily have been the fate of Rhodesia. In fact, the Rhodesian Army and Air Force are a fraction of the size of what the British faced when they were fighting in the Falkland Islands. The British could have come and knocked us out overnight. Their Air Force was strong enough. They had all the means to do it. We'll look a little bit at the military aspects of it a bit later in this video, but the point is, for the British to come and have knocked the whites out would not have been difficult. It was well within the power of the British military to do it, with absolute ease. Absolute ease. They could have bombed us, they could have dropped paratroopers, they could have invaded us. They had so many ways to work out a military plan to come and smash us, and we'd be a walkover. We'd be a walkover. This would be nothing like the Boer War. This would be nothing like the Falkland Islands. We'd be an absolute walkover. If the British wanted to seize control of Rhodesia in a weekend, they could have done it. They had the power. But they didn't, and we're going to get back to that. And notice in all these discussions, the talk of invasion, 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 the blacks not liking the sanctions, and the blacks are demanding, and I'll tell you even more about this later, the blacks are demanding that Britain invade Rhodesia. Notice that when Harold Wilson, in this film footage you're going to see, Harold Wilson comes to Salisbury. Harold Wilson is trying to stop UDI. And Ian Smith rejects any British proposal that leads to majority rule. He rejects any proposal that leads to black rule. And the blacks are demanding military intervention, an invasion. And they use the words to stop Smith, if necessary, by force. So, on the 30th of October 1965, Harold Wilson says that the demands to settle the Rhodesian problem through military force is not going to happen. And in this video, they are constantly harping on the fact that the military invasion is not going to happen because of some kind of political considerations. Notice how the British managed to wangle their way around this issue. But the constant talk in this video is the threat of British invasion. The Rhodesians are afraid of it, but they're taking the risk anyway. And this talk that Britain must attack. So Wilson says, there won't be a thunderbolt coming from the sky in the form of the Royal Air Force. It's not going to happen. But then there's Dennis Healy, the Minister of Defence. So then the Rhodesians see the weakness of the British and the Rhodesians go for it. And interestingly enough, they actually have some Rhodesian TV footage, which I must tell you, I last saw in 1980. I'd forgotten what Rhodesian TV looked like, and it was in black and white. And if you look carefully, it'll be RTV for Rhodesian TV. But yeah, you'll see a bit of TV footage. But the real issue here is the military stuff. Now notice that they then start talking about Britain as the enemy and that Britain will use any means. But notice now that the whites dominate all the instruments of power. The whites control the parliament, whites control the police, whites control the army. You'll even see some black troops there, but the whites are in charge, and the whites control everything, the legal system, you name it. And this is what really is the kicker, is that the whites don't have to go and rebel to seize power. The whites already have the power in their hands, everything under their control. And even though that small group of whites, of 200,000 whites, rules 3 million blacks, the whites are in charge, and the blacks are at our mercy, and the whites are not intending to give up power. And you see, they explain to you in this film footage that only Rhodesia could dare to do a rebellion, because in all the other colonies, the settlers did not have this power to rule. These whites are in control of everything and have been since 1923, legally, by agreement with Britain. So it all boils down to the fact that we've got physical control of everything already and we're not going to give it up without a fight. So they try to explain it away by saying that, oh well, there are reasons why he couldn't dare to do an invasion because it would affect his politics, etc., etc. They duck and dive on this military invasion issue, and we're going to come back to this later. But the point is just to make you fully aware that that is how serious the situation was. And then you'll see that as the years go by, Ian Smith is asked, how did things go? And he says, well, it went better than we expected. And he's quite pleased with it. The blacks, who are watching the thing, are irritated by the fact that even sanctions, even total international sanctions against Rhodesia is not working. Portugal and South Africa are ignoring international sanctions by the United Nations and still trading with Rhodesia. So thanks to the South Africans and the Portuguese, we just carry on. For us, it's business as usual. Even though the United Nations has said total economic sanctions. It's not totally business as usual because all the stuff that we do other than South Africa and Portugal that is cut off. All trade with Britain is cut off. All trade with Europe is cut off. Trade with America is cut off except for chrome. Nobody mentions that. Chrome is sold by Rhodesia to America, and I later learned that at various times, I think even Russia bought chrome from Rhodesia. So on the whole, sanctions, it does affect us, but we do all kinds of things to beat it, and we're not doing badly. We're surviving the only real thing that the British have got on us, which is sanctions. And Ian Smith is so confident that even though Wilson gets him onto various Royal Navy vessels and they talk there, etc., you'll see that Ian Smith is walking around on those Royal Navy vessels. He's well treated. He seems very happy. I've heard it said by some people who've written articles in the right wing. They've said that, oh no, when Ian Smith was on those vessels, he was badly treated. He was pushed into a corner. Here you can see the film footage for yourself. You'll see him walking around talking to the captain. He's even given a telescope. He's looking very happy. So it doesn't look that bad to me. Plus, he rejects all the proposals by the British. Anything that leads to black rule, he rejects it. The closest they come to talking about the invasion is they say that an invasion could lead to a long and bloody war with our kith and kin, which I must say is quite uplifting, because I wouldn't have imagined a long and bloody war. But anyhow, they kind of tried to explain this away as them not invading us because of political considerations. And as you can see, the British Prime Minister's jumping around trying different things, and Ian Smith is feeling confident enough that he rejects one proposal on top of another. All these events that you are seeing are happening in the 1960s until towards the latter part of the 1960s. Then this stuff settles down into a point where Rhodesia's intransigent, the blacks are intransigent, the British are intransigent, nothing is moving forward. The only thing now is the war, and the Rhodesians hang on. But for your purposes, the main thing here to watch are these things in this little video about the late 1960s and the stress over Britain possibly invading Rhodesia. And so eventually they say that Wilson asks his civil servants to find something other than invasion as a tool, and they settle on international sanctions. So watch this little video, and then after this I'm going to tell you the real secret.
And saw them in 1964, and was frankly horrified. Ian Smith and his cabinet seemed to me to be like a set of white ostriches. Nothing that I or Harold Wilson or anybody else said to them made the slightest difference. I said they'd got minds like Polaroid sunglasses. Only welcome information penetrated. Anything unwelcome simply didn't get through.
Smith refused independence on his terms, resolved to seize it by a unilateral declaration of independence. His security advisers told him UDI would be too dangerous. In October 1965, he called them to a meeting.
Ian Smith in the chair said that it now had to be a political decision. His colleagues would make that decision. We were all to prepare for UDI, but await a favorable opportunity for its implementation. That opportunity came surprisingly within a couple of weeks.
The British Prime Minister arrived in Salisbury, desperate to find some compromise to avoid UDI. But Smith rejected any plan that might lead to majority rule. the African leaders looked to Britain to stop Smith, if necessary, by force.
I've had to tell them that their demand for Britain to attempt to settle all Rhodesia's constitutional problems with a military invasion, this demand is out. And if there are those in this country who are thinking in terms of a thunderbolt hurtling from the sky and destroying their enemies, a thunderbolt in the shape of the Royal Air Force, let me say that thunderbolt will not be coming.
I think it was insane. I simply cannot understand the Prime Minister letting Ian Smith know that we wouldn't intervene by force, because in a situation where you've so few cards in your hand, you mustn't tell the other side that you have no cards.
This, in effect, gave the Rhodesian government their opportunity. Because, if I remember, it was within a matter of hours that the Rhodesian cabinet met on the 1st of November and confirmed the decision to go for UDI.
The following message was sent today from the Prime Minister. I remind everyone in the services that first and foremost, he is the servant of Rhodesia, his country, and of its government. The British government will not hesitate to employ every device, legal or otherwise, that occurred to them to sow doubts in the minds of civil servants, members of the armed forces and of the prison service, and to detach these services from their loyalty to the government and to Rhodesia itself.
Only Rhodesia could have dared a UDI. In other colonies, the British authorities could quell a settler rebellion, but Rhodesia was unique. They had their own police, civil service, and armed forces under the settlers' control. The only way Britain could stop UDI was by military invasion. But Harold Wilson had a parliamentary majority of only one, and a general election was coming. He feared the reaction of his electorate. An invasion could lead to a long and bloody war with their Rhodesian kith and kin. He asked his civil servants to come up with something else.
We civil servants sat in our bath, and the only thing we could come up with was some middle course between the extreme of doing nothing, which Harold Wilson obviously wouldn't have, and the extreme of using force, unacceptable for many reasons. So all we could think of in the middle was economic sanctions.
We believed right from the beginning that sanctions were a farce and that they're not going to work.
Joshua Nkomo, the father of Zimbabwe nationalism, had long been fighting for African rights. He had been rounded up along with the other nationalist leaders. The Smith regime kept them in detention for the next 10 years.
Sitting in detention in our camps in Gwanagudzingwa, where the railway line passed a few meters away from our gates, we could see the tankers go past from Lorenzo Marx. And as we had said to Mr. Wilson, when he said the sanctions were the trump card, and we said, we did not believe there could be a sufficient trump card when Wilson himself had said nothing was going to be done to any petroleum products coming from South Africa.
We were worried for, I suppose, a month or so, uncertain. But nothing terrible happened. In fact, it was a little better than we had expected, you see. And then it gradually got better, not worse. We became industrially self-sufficient. We developed a much broader base to our whole economy and our industry. It was a shot in the arm.
Sanctions failed to bring the rebels to their knees. Black Commonwealth leaders demanded action. Wilson, still determined not to use force, pursued Smith on land and on sea. He pleaded with him to promise the blacks majority rule, so Britain could recognize White Rhodesia's independence and shed this thankless responsibility.
Yes,
Wilson made increasingly generous offers, but Smith turned down every one.
In this short video, you'll hear Ian Smith speaking in 1967. And I should mention that I think it's pretty rare that you'd find a white man talking so frankly about many things. And when he talks about those to the north of us, he's referring to all the black states that have been created through decolonization, and that basically those blacks got everything for nothing, and then these blacks after a time want to then run back to the colonial powers with their begging bowls. You see, the blacks are different to the whites. And notice the way that Smith speaks, where he says that's not the kind of independence that he's interested in. Whites are much tougher people, and we've got firmer minds. And in some respects, we can also stand up to other whites, as well as Jews, in ways that nobody else can. But what Smith represents is that white nationalist determination to do your own thing and to not tolerate others mucking you around. And he also mentions, of course, that we were independent before we illegally declared our independence, because we had ruled ourselves for 40 years. Or rather, the whites had been ruling the whites and the blacks for that period of time. So he's feeling quite confident and determined. And that is a reflection of the way the whites were of that time. Something which I miss in this globalist junk world, I must tell you. And you see, the big thing when he talks about the unsuccessful British policy is the policy of dumping the colonies. But now, this is where you've got a clash, where the whites who live there know that we are going to be negatively impacted if we just hand over the country to the blacks. Whereas the British are dumping their entire colonial empire, and they don't want to look after it, basically. Now, exactly why the British want to dump their colonial empire, that is another topic for another day. An important topic, but not critical for here. The British have already decided that they don't want this empire. In part, because they've already realized that communism is at work and they are not going to be able to retain it. So they are just approaching this by dumping the whole thing, saying to everybody, okay, you want your country, here it is, there it is. And the British are actually disingenuous to the blacks. The blacks themselves are disingenuous scumbags. They've got their eyes set on seizing chunks of territory, and they're saying, we want to rule ourselves. And the British are well aware that this is not going to work, but the British don't want to run into problems with the blacks. So on the basis of trade and political expediency and diplomacy, the British are like, yeah, you can have your country. And the British are saying, yes, this is successful, this is great, this is fantastic. And the whites who live there are looking at it, and we're seeing, no way, man, this isn't going well. This is going to destroy our lives. And that is where some of the clash between Britain and Rhodesia comes from, where the Rhodesians are saying, but this ain't going to work, man. So you've got Britain on the one hand, Rhodesia on the other hand, and we are totally at odds with each other. What is good for Britain is not good for Rhodesia. And that, I'm afraid, is the way this thing plays out. But some of these topics we'll come back to later. Also, notice the audience. Audience is white. And I quite enjoy the way he says, we've set our course and we're going to paddle our own canoe. So we don't have a boat or a ship, but we got a canoe at least. But he's determined, and that is what whites do when whites are busy with their own projects. And for me, it's a good thing. I like it when whites are strong and determined and we got a plan. Even if the plan fails later, as this one does. The fact of the matter is, this guy bought us white rule for the next 14 years. If we'd just handed over to the blacks, things would have collapsed. There are Rhodesians who then argue, no, but you know, we could have worked out things, and maybe it could have worked better. I'm not going to go into that discussion. I'm still saying to you that the bottom line is we had white control for the next 14 years. And that for me was a great thing.
There can be any doubt in anybody's mind. We speak from experience. We know what we are talking about. We have been successful because we were virtually independent before we declared our independence. And this is the big failure as far as so many of the countries to the north of us were concerned. They got something by name handed to them on a plate, but in reality, in fact, they didn't have it. They never had it. And when you've got to go cap in hand the next day asking for help from other people, then this is not independence. It is certainly not the sort of independence that I would wish to have. We've got real independence. We have proved our case. We know that it is successful. And we have lived cheek by jowl with a British policy in Africa. We have seen it fail and crumple. We have seen how unsuccessful it has been. So there is no alternative. And if we were to pause for one moment to consider any other such alternative that may be put before us, then, ladies and gentlemen, I say to you, we would be stark, staring mad. No, sir. We have set our course, and from now on it is our intention to go on paddling our own canoe. Thank you.
Take a look at this image here. The guy you see on the cover of this magazine, Kenneth Kaunda. That's his name, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. This guy was the president of the newly independent state of Zambia, previously Northern Rhodesia. You can see he is saying here, "What we are now witnessing here is the beginning of a racial holocaust." So this is what Kenneth Kaunda is saying. Now this Kenneth Kaunda became one of the biggest, if not the biggest, thorn in the side of the whites of Southern Africa, especially Rhodesia. This guy was very keen to get the British to invade us. And later on, this guy took other actions that led to many problems for us. If there was a black state that we should have invaded in the beginning, it should have been Kenneth Kaunda's Zambia. Because this guy initially demanded that the British actually invade Rhodesia. And he was happy to have the British come to his country and use his country as a launch pad to invade us. However, early on, he was already giving the blacks of Rhodesia a base from which to function, which was his country. His country was the country from which our war began. But it is his invitation to the British to invade us and his constant demands for it. And make no mistake, he wasn't alone. All the other black leaders in Africa, in newly independent Africa, were calling on Britain to invade Rhodesia. But this guy was the key player. Now that map that you see in front of you there, this is a map of northern Rhodesia, southern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland. And if you look on this map, northern Rhodesia is the country that later becomes Zambia, which is where Kenneth Kaunda was the president. Interestingly enough, this map is titled Rhodesia and Nyasaland. This was a temporary creation by the British before they dumped their colonies, where they created a huge country out of these three colonies with northern Rhodesia, southern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland. And the whites of southern Rhodesia ruled that entire area that you see there. That entire area is very slightly bigger than South Africa. But that's a topic for another day. There are also lessons that come out of this political experiment that lasted a couple of years. Rhodesia and Nyasaland, in a nutshell, is a British liberal experiment that went wrong. And it's the same kind of experiment that Americans do. And the reason that it goes wrong is because the blacks do not want to be part of this. The blacks decide that they want nationalism. And so they don't want to be part of something else run by whites, even if it benefits them. They want their own pieces of territory. So this thing breaks up, and Nyasaland breaks away and becomes Malawi. Northern Rhodesia under Kaunda breaks away and becomes Zambia. And the British give all these blacks independence, but then when the whites of southern Rhodesia try to call on the independence deal from the past, the British play their game. There's no ways in hell, no ways in hell, the British are going to create a white-run country in Africa. They are not going to do it. And it doesn't matter what promises they made, what was said in the past, etc. But now the key thing in this map that I want you to look at is take a look at the border between northern Rhodesia and southern Rhodesia. Also, take notice that northern Rhodesia, which is now under black rule, is much bigger than southern Rhodesia. It's enormous. And it's got copper mines up in the north. It's making a ton of money. So these blacks have got a lovely territory that is absolutely enormous. And it is running very well thanks to the copper mines. And now the president of northern Rhodesia, or rather Zambia, the president is saying to the British, you must come and invade southern Rhodesia. And he's saying to them, you can use my country as the point, the invasion point, into this white colony in the south. You must attack the whites and destroy the whites and see to it that black rule comes to southern Rhodesia. And this becomes a point that the blacks across Africa support. They want the British to invade southern Rhodesia. And Kaunda is so insistent on this that later the British actually send the Royal Air Force and whites from the British Royal Air Force go to Zambia and they get bases there and they start flying patrols there. And can you believe that the British planes of the Royal Air Force go and patrol along the border between Zambia and Rhodesia in order to protect in order to protect this black country from the, quote, military threat of the whites of Rhodesia. Can you believe that the British did that? And those British aircraft were in Zambia for quite some time. However, despite what these dirty, filthy politicians are doing, things don't quite work out like these filthy politicians, filthy, weak, pathetic, scum politicians in Britain are stooping to. And let me just say that these planes, I think these planes come after UDI. I did a bit of research and I found something which clarifies and proves exactly what I'm telling you. On Facebook, I found this Brit who posted the following information, and he had a page called Ndola My City. Ndola is a town in northern Zambia where the copper mines are, and lots of whites worked in Zambia on the copper mines, Brits and other whites from elsewhere. So they constituted like the biggest portion of the white population in Zambia in those times. Now, he posted this photo of this aircraft. And he says here, damaged RAF Gloster Javelin. And it says the following. Now, remember that Wilson had said he's not going to engage in an invasion. But even so, the British are taking some kinds of military action, but it's not working out well. And I'll explain to you. So take a look at this. His photo is damaged RAF Gloster Javelin. And it says, in 1965, Rhodesia declared UDI from Great Britain. One of the measures taken by the UK was to send a squadron of Gloster Javelin aircraft to Ndola, Zambia, the former British colony of northern Rhodesia. This was quite soon after UDI. I imagine 1966 onwards, and that does sound right. One of the aircraft from 29 Squadron, XH-890, force landed at Ndola and was damaged beyond economical repair. The aircraft was moved to a children's playground in Ndola. These photographs show it several years later, early 1970s. The photographs came from William Hunter Johnson, who in turn, I think, obtained them from someone else. Please get in touch if you took these photographs. Now, listen to this. Of interest, Salisbury, that's the capital of Rhodesia, Salisbury radar controlled all airspace in the region. After takeoff, the Royal Air Force flight leader would contact the, quote, rebels in Salisbury radar, Salisbury Airport, for clearance to fly a border patrol along the Zambia-Rhodesia border. There is a good chance that some of the 29 Squadron had spent time in Rhodesia on attachment. It goes without saying, I hope, that many serving members of the Rhodesian Air Force in the 1960s, still the Royal Rhodesian Air Force, royal to the Queen of England, had served with the British Royal Air Force. Even the Rhodesian Prime Minister, Ian Smith, had been a Royal Air Force pilot flying and fighting in Italy. He was injured having been shot down whilst fighting for Queen and country. That is quite true. Ian Smith had been a fighter pilot in World War II, fighting for Britain. And so what they are showing you here, this guy is showing you this damaged Gloucester Javelin in Indola. There you can see a little black kid playing on the damaged plane that the British left in Indola. And here you can see another photo of the damaged plane. You can see the blacks on the ground. So this is in Zambia. This is after UDI. And this was at the behest of this black shitbag, Kenneth Kaunda. So there you have it. And notice how this guy mentions that the British or the Royal Air Force, that the guys from the Royal Air Force had to talk to the white rebels in another country in order to get their permission to fly border patrols, because we were the only ones with functioning radar and we controlled the radar in the entire region. So here's an independent black country that doesn't even have the ability to control its own radar at that time, or the ability to control the airspace at that time. But that'll give you an idea of what these stupid British politicians got up to. Now, the truth of the matter is that these white pilots from the Royal Air Force, they were on very good terms with the white guys in Rhodesia. So here they are representing Britain, the enemy, and flying these patrols to protect Zambia, this black shitbag country run by this partially communist or wanting to be communist black leader. And meanwhile, the guys are yakking away on the airwaves and there's no hostility between them. And in actual fact, the Royal Air Force guys were invited to party with the Rhodesian guys. And these guys, I think, even had Christmases together. I don't know for how long the Royal Air Force was in Zambia, but it was for quite a time. And they got along well with the Rhodesians. And these whites knew these guys as their buddies because they'd fought together. Not only had they fought together in World War II, but they'd fought together in many places since World War II. Because the Rhodesians were unique in Africa. The Rhodesians were the only whites in any of the British colonies that actually stuck with Britain regardless of what stupid Jewish Britain gets up to. So when the British had to fight in Malaysia, the army and the air force went and fought in Malaysia alongside the Royal Air Force. When there was a war up in Aden, which I think is up there in what is now Yemen, when there was a communist insurgency up there in Yemen, the Rhodesian Air Force flew all the way from Central Africa to go and fight alongside the Brits up in Yemen. Whenever and wherever the British needed assistance, the Rhodesians in Central Africa were jumping in their planes and heading off to help the British fight wherever they needed to fight. And these guys in the Royal Air Force, etc., and the British Army, they knew the Rhodesians because they were comrades in arms. And wherever the British had to face a battle where the Rhodesians could get involved, the Rhodesians were there. So no matter what these shitbag politicians were saying and hoping, the fact of the matter is that the military people knew each other and they were on good terms with each other. And they spoke to each other on the radio and they chatted and they joked and they met each other and they partied and they drank beer and all that. So that'll give you a bit of an idea of the Royal Air Force in Zambia and this shitbag black and all the other black shitbags who want the Royal Air Force to come and invade Rhodesia. And now Britain has to put up this sort of pretense that they are going to patrol and send aircraft to defend Zambia from the white rebels to the south. But quite disgusting that the British stooped so low. However, their military people followed orders, but they were never going to do anything to the whites because they knew them as brothers in arms. I did manage to find some film footage of the arrival of the British Air Force in Zambia in 1965. Check these blacks looking at a jet engine. No idea what that white man's magic is, eh? And here you can see a Gloster Javelin coming in. There you can see a transport aircraft coming in. This film footage is from British Pathé, and they put out this film footage without sound, saying that it's unused. I found that quite a few news organizations are putting out unused film footage from the past, and all of it, by the way, doesn't have sound. And for the record, for those of you who don't know, all film footage of World War II is exactly like this. The film footage is without sound. They didn't record sound. So when you hear sound and sounds of battle in World War II, all of that sound was added afterwards. This is what the actual film footage is like. So here you can see the Royal Air Force. And there's the Gloster Javelins. But there are also other aircraft. There are also other transport aircraft. Coming to the black state of Zambia to come and protect them from the terrible white rebels to the south. Britain protecting its black kith and kin. And so here you see these blacks helping to unload these planes. Another Gloster Javelin. And you can see the pilots, white guys, who are supposed to come and protect these blacks from their rebellious kith and kin to the south. And these guys end up getting along great with their kith and kin who've rebelled against Britain. And there's a transport aircraft. I don't know what kind of transport aircraft these are. It's obviously a British type. I'm no expert on this. This might be Lusaka, the capital, unless this is, of course, Ndola. Maybe this is Ndola. So here are the British Air Force. Let's just see what else there is to comment about. There are different bits of film footage. When I see something worthwhile, I'll comment on it. There you can see Zambia Airlines. There you can see the registration numbers, and the registration number is similar to the one that was mentioned by that other guy who took that other footage. So, quite lovely aircraft for the time, the Gloster Javelin. Probably a lot more advanced than anything Rhodesia had. So, these white guys sent to come and protect the blacks from the white rebels. And these planes were here for quite a while. Check all these blacks looking at these planes. Africa is lovely. Here you can probably see this is Lake Kariba. At the time, the greatest man-made lake in the world. Lake Kariba provided electricity for Zambia and Rhodesia, northern and southern Rhodesia. Not built by these idiots, built by whites. Lake Kariba. A very important investment by the whites of the time. So that's pretty much the end of that. On the border between Zambia and Rhodesia. Let me show you a few other things pertaining to Rhodesia and a British invasion. So here you have Rhodesia and there is Zambia over there. There's Lake Kariba. Like I say, at the time, the largest man-made lake in the world. And shortly thereafter, the Portuguese, by the way, built the next greatest, largest man-made lake in the world over here in Mozambique. Sadly, the Portuguese never got to see their wonderful investment coming through. They lost power before they could get to see the benefits. But now what we have is we've got the British in Zambia, probably at Ndola, and then flying their patrols along the border here. The other place that was of interest to Rhodesia and critical importance was in Mozambique, Portuguese Mozambique. Here is Beira. And Beira was the closest port to Rhodesia. Rhodesia being landlocked. And all our fuel came from Beira until the Portuguese went down, in which case we started getting stuff from South Africa, a longer distance. But in that time of UDI, in the time after the declaration of UDI, Beira was one port here, and further down is Lorenzo Marques. Now, the British sent the Royal Navy into the Indian Ocean to intercept all oil supplies to Rhodesia. And they came to intercept all the oil supplies and any oil tankers that were coming to Beira to drop off the oil for Rhodesia were turned back by the Royal Navy. So the Royal Navy probably carried out the most important tasks in cutting our supply line. But that was all they did. They just came and turned the ships back so that we couldn't get oil directly. Though we did still get oil through the Portuguese. And I'm not sure how it worked exactly. I'm not sure whether some tankers managed to get through. I'm not sure if the Portuguese ended up purchasing the oil and we bought it from the Portuguese. I don't know the details. But the bottom line is that if the British wanted to invade us, they could also have come and used the port of Beira. And to be honest with you, I can't see that either the Portuguese or the South Africans would have got involved if the British invaded Rhodesia. I don't think that either the Portuguese or the South Africans would have wanted to mess with Britain. I think that regardless of what the British wanted to do, that the others would have stood aside and let the British do it, because it's a fight between Rhodesia and Britain. In the case of actually invading Rhodesia, the topic that's come up the most is the idea of bombing Rhodesia. And the two biggest cities were Salisbury and Bulawayo, could easily have been bombed. The British were well within their ability to do it if they'd wanted to. We did have an air force, but I wouldn't want to go and speculate on our air force fighting the British air force. The British would have been superior in any way they wanted to. If the British wanted to come and invade Rhodesia, if they didn't want to use the port to land troops or do something like that, probably the easiest way to have invaded us would have just been to fly all the aircraft and troops that they need down through Africa, because they can land anywhere, and fly them down, land them in Zambia, organize everything, and carry out an air and ground invasion. They could have parachuted SAS troops into Salisbury. They could have bombed us. They could have shot down our aircraft, and so on. I don't think it would have been a protracted fight. I think they would have been able to crush us quite easily. They would just have had to build up quite a serious force in Zambia. And we ourselves would not be in a position to stop them. If they really wanted to fight us, they could easily have built up bases for themselves up in Zambia, flown in everything that they needed, defended their bases. We couldn't have touched them. We wouldn't have gone and bombed them. I can't see that happening. Not at that stage. And they could have built up their forces, and they could then have come and attacked as and how it suited them. I don't really think that they would have had military resistance from the Rhodesians. I don't think so. I think if Britain really wanted to invade us, they could have. And I don't know of any particular plans to fight them. And even if we did fight them, I can't imagine that we would have really wanted to do that. I think that the goal of our politicians was to try and break away without having to fight Britain. But if Britain had wanted to put us in our place, like they did with the Argentinians who invaded the Falklands, the British had the means. The British definitely had the means, had the technology. You know, if we'd sent any aircraft up, they could have shot them down with missiles. They could have easily shot them down with their own aircraft. I really don't think that we would have been a serious threat to the British. Probably the closest to this would have been like the British and the Boers, where the British invaded South Africa and they then fought and crushed the Boers. But I'm not so sure that the Rhodesians would have actually fought the British. However, the risk was real, and I just wanted to show you that the British had the means, and they were definitely making some kinds of moves in this regard. There was military force, and it was a military force that Rhodesia could not really have resisted at that point in time. And I can't see that those people, that any of those guys would have wanted to actually fight the British. So, let me tell you the real reason why Britain didn't invade Rhodesia. Because, as you've heard constantly, invasion, invasion, the topic keeps coming up, invasion, invasion, at that time. But why didn't they actually invade? Well, Ian Smith, whom you see here, our leader, he finally wrote his memoirs decades later. And in his memoirs, he tells the inside story of how he viewed things. And basically, his assessment of the risks of the time. So they were fully aware of the risks of what they were doing, and that it was illegal, and that Rhodesia could be invaded by Britain, or should be invaded by Britain, but they knew the British very well. And so, in his memoirs, in chapter 10, where it says, the immediate consequences of UDI, he writes the following. Clearly, our UDI would infuriate the starry-eyed liberals and the frustrated communists. But I was placing my faith in the theory that sudden storms are short. Wilson was dashing hither and thither in London, making extravagant statements. Certain African states were demanding an immediate invasion by British forces. If only they could have had a bird's eye view of Rhodesia, they would have realized the stupidity of their behavior, because otherwise things there were completely normal and calm, an oasis of peace in an otherwise turbulent continent. The day after our declaration, I visited Government House accompanied by DuPont and Lardner Burke to clear up Gibbs' position. Let me just pause there. I think they're getting rid of the British governor, or the British are going to withdraw their governor. He had changed his stance from the previous day when he told me he would go back to his farm in Matabele land and try to get some more milk out of his cows. Let me just pause there. This is Sir Humphrey Gibbs. Sir Humphrey Gibbs was the governor of southern Rhodesia. So he was like the proper official British representative in Rhodesia. And as you can see, he's enjoying life in Rhodesia. He's got a farm and he's busy farming. He's quite concerned about his cattle. White men love to farm. Agriculture is a very important part of our civilization. And you'll see it coming up again and again everywhere. Wherever whites settle, you'll see the first thing they do is they start farming. Everybody loves to farm. I will add another little point here with Sir Humphrey Gibbs. Now, on Wikipedia, it also mentions a few things about this Rhodesian rebellion that's totally illegal. And let's look at what it says here regarding Humphrey Gibbs. It says here, under siege. Now, this shows you some division among the Rhodesians. Look at this. It says, several high-ranking officers of the Rhodesian military went to Governor Gibbs earlier in the day, made a statement of loyalty to him, and asked Gibbs to issue a warrant so they could arrest Smith and DuPont. This is a reference to Clifford DuPont. Ian Smith was the first guy to sign our Declaration of Independence, and Clifford DuPont was the second. So, here are some high-ranking military officers in Rhodesia who are willing to switch sides and remain loyal to Britain. So, it says the following. However, Gibbs knew that the bulk of the officer corps, as well as the rank and file of the Rhodesian military, were solidly behind Ian Smith's government, and that such a move would lead to a coup d'etat. Gibbs announced that despite the UDI, he had no intention of resigning his office or leaving Rhodesia. I wonder if his cattle farm is calling. And that therefore he would remain in Government House in Salisbury as the sole legal representative of Queen Elizabeth II. With few exceptions, the international community continued to recognize him as the Queen's sole legitimate representative and thus the only lawful authority in what London maintained was still the colony of Southern Rhodesia. In response, Smith declared that Government House was only temporarily occupied by Gibbs in a personal capacity and would be occupied by DuPont once it became available. This led to 4 years of harassment and petty afflictions by the Rhodesian government, resulting in making Gibbs and his wife virtually prisoners in Government House by cutting off his telephone, electricity and water. So there's a tiny little battle there going on between the official governor of Rhodesia, who's not keen to leave, but he occupies Government House. And it says that the Rhodesian government also took away his ceremonial guard, official cars, and sent him bills for the rent of Government House, which he refused to pay. However, his supporters set up a governor's fund to pay for the upkeep of the building, and with the assistance of a small staff, led by Sir John Pestle, he managed to remain defiant. So he's the only legal representative of Britain in Rhodesia. And so a little diplomatic row on a small scale there. Just a few other points about Gibbs, because it explains when and how Rhodesia got rid of him. In 1967, on the second anniversary of UDI, Gibbs declared that his visitor's book would be open to all those who wished to show their loyalty to the Queen, while DuPont, in response, announced that the visitor's book at his office on the same street would be open to all those who wished to show their support for UDI. In June 1969, Gibbs resigned after Smith's government held and won a referendum that year, making Rhodesia a republic. He remained in Rhodesia and lived the rest of his life on his farm between 1970 and 1983. So he did stay on his farm. In fact, he lived in what was Zimbabwe until 1990. So Sir Humphrey Gibbs did enjoy life in Rhodesia. But let's return to Ian Smith's book and continue. So just to continue, the day after our declaration, I visited Government House accompanied by DuPont and Lardner Burke to clear up Gibbs's position. He had changed his stance from the previous day when he told me he would go back to his farm in Matabele land and try to get some more milk out of his cows. Not surprisingly, the British government had asked him to remain at his post as, in their eyes, he was still the governor. In fact, because of the new constitution which we had brought in, his authority no longer existed and the maintenance of his pretense was of little concern to us. So these Rhodesians are just showing the British system the finger. I gave instructions that he should be allowed to continue living in the residence with no pressures placed on him, though Wikipedia says otherwise. So maybe they did put some subtle pressure on him, sending him bills to pay for rent. Rhodesia dominated the correspondence between the heads of the Commonwealth for a few days, with Wilson stating that it was the government's intention to restore legality and freedom in Rhodesia. Had he been truthful, he would have admitted that there was more freedom in Rhodesia than any other country in Africa, except for South Africa, if I may say, and that constitutionally, the action which we had taken was necessary in order to implement the agreement which we made at the Victoria Falls Conference. Wilson also stated, and this is the important part, Wilson also stated that there was no intention to use force, and this came as no surprise because I had heard through my security channels that he had received a positive message from his chiefs of staff that any thought of military action would be a non-starter. So, that is the key sentence in all of this. That the military, the various chiefs of staff in Britain, had indicated to the Prime Minister, Wilson, that if he wanted to make use of any force, the military were not going to do it. And so that was Ian Smith's little secret inside piece of information that he was gambling on. And so that is the real reason why the British politicians could not invade Rhodesia, was the chiefs of staff of the British military told them that they are not going to invade Rhodesia. And Ian Smith explains more. He continues, "This was logical to anyone who understood the intimate relationship between the Rhodesian and British security forces, and the great loyalty and dedication which Rhodesia had always shown. In the last war, this is World War II, our Army and Air Force units were integrated with the British, and this had continued up to UDI. Every year, one of our Air Force squadrons flew to Aden," that's where I mentioned the war up in what is now Yemen, "every year one of our Air Force squadrons flew to Aden, where they indulged in combined operations with the RAF over a period of 1 month. We had constant radio communications with RAF Aden, and our crack SAS, that's the Special Forces, Special Air Services, unit was on call, ready for service with the British Army. Nowhere else in Africa did anything like this apply. So any politician in Britain who contemplated a fratricidal war against Rhodesia was living in the dark. The heads of the security forces in Britain were not interested in appeasing the communist aspirations of the OAU, that's the Organization of African Unity. All the blacks united by this front. It's now known as the African Union. They were more concerned with the qualities of loyalty and honesty and the bonds of friendship which held us together. Just as important were the ties of family and nationality, which had preserved the British Empire during times of stress. They had not forgotten the last World War, when together we faced what appeared to be imminent disaster. We were disappointed at the performance of the Conservative Party, which, apart from a few of our staunch and loyal friends, allowed themselves to be taken along by Wilson, offering a few mild suggestions about practicing moderation. They let Wilson get away with using, as an excuse for his retaliatory actions, his concern that undesirable foreign powers might exploit our successful defiance as a pretext for gaining a foothold on the continent. The Tories should have immediately pointed out that his recent mishandling of the Rhodesian problem leading to UDI was giving a great boost to the communist campaign in Africa and was in fact aiding and abetting the communists in securing their existing foothold in Africa. Here was incontrovertible evidence that Wilson and the Labour Party were undermining a country which had a worldwide reputation for promoting the concept of Western democracy and the free enterprise system. So it was Wilson, not Smith, who was creating the fertile ground for hostile foreign penetration into Africa. Another pertinent fact given to me at the time was that the communists were supplying arms to their terrorist allies in Africa to carry out their brutal attacks on innocent civilians. And now Wilson was cutting off arms supplies to Rhodesia that should have been used to maintain law and order and to protect our citizens. The only time they had ever been used beyond our borders was to assist Britain in its role as an international peace force. But this was now conveniently forgotten as part of the exercise to placate the OAU, Organization of African Unity, and the UN. Let me jump now to a section where he deals with Kaunda and the Royal Air Force going to Zambia. Smith says, Kaunda of Zambia was under pressure from some of his OAU friends to cut his links with us. I think Smith is quite kind to Kaunda, but anyway. But he had enough sense to realize that this would have meant committing suicide because his transport links to the ports for his exports and imports ran through Rhodesia. The essential coal and coke for Zambia's copper production and many of their other industrial requirements came from Rhodesia. It was one thing for those countries to the north that had no contact with us to preach boycott, since they were thinking only of their own selfish interests, but it would have been quite another for Kaunda. However, Kaunda did hit on a tactic, probably with Wilson's connivance. He asked for British troops and an RAF squadron to move into Zambia. Let me pause there. These are the aircraft that you saw in that film footage. So let me just continue. And an RAF squadron to move into Zambia on the pretext of it providing protection for Zambia's power supplies and mines. We had communicated with Kaunda, assuring him of our intention to maintain normal communications and supplies. So it was clear that this was a maneuver to placate certain people. Both Wilson and Kaunda could point out to the OAU that they were taking the necessary steps to frustrate the evil intentions of the wicked Rhodesians. My diary records a number of interesting and comic events associated with this exercise. Air traffic control in Salisbury handled all traffic passing from northern Africa southwards, as there was no other contact. When the RAF squadrons landed at their destination in Lusaka, Zambia, they signed off by saying, "Goodbye and thanks, Salisbury." Back came the reply, "Goodbye, RAF, and enjoy yourselves." So the Royal Air Force and the Rhodesians chatting friendly-like. The British, both RAF and Army, soon made contact with the Rhodesians on the other side of the Zambezi at Victoria Falls and Kariba, and paid regular visits in the evenings to their messes, and on both Christmas and New Year's Eve joined enthusiastically in the toast to Smith and Rhodesia. This took place both north and south of the river, so we were not surprised to hear that the RAF squadron commander told Arthur Bottomley that his pilots had made it clear that they would not comply with an order to attack Rhodesia. On the humorous side, my PPS, I'm not sure what he means by PPS, said, with a smile on his face, that our Air Force commander had been on the phone with a message from his CO, commanding officer, at Victoria Falls, who had received an SOS for help from his RAF counterpart on the northern bank of the river. The message related that Bottomley had waved his farewell hand towards the Zambians who were attending his departure, saying, "There are no more noble creatures on this earth, and we have so much in common with them." So it seems like the British politician is calling the Zambians, the black Zambians, "There are no more noble creatures on earth, and we have so much in common with them." Oh, goodness. The RAF officers had spent much time trying to work that one out. So there you go. Military are like, "What shit is this politician talking?" Maybe politicians will be more intelligent than airmen. And was I able to help them with their problem? Interestingly, Bottomley was not on his own, as another British minister, Cledwyn Hughes, in a farewell speech to the British troops before leaving for home, ended by saying, "I wish you all a happy white Christmas." So, snow in tropical Africa in the middle of summer? Not quite. The depths to which the British government were prepared to descend in their vindictiveness were disclosed in their action in stopping the payment of pensions to their British pensioners living in Rhodesia. I responded by making the decision that not only would we continue to pay Rhodesian pensioners living in Britain, but that we would also pay the British pensioners living in Rhodesia who had been forsaken by their own government. Two wrongs do not make a right. We will not descend to the level of the British government. The British then resorted to another underhand trick, which was frowned upon in international circles and which also had a boomerang effect. They seized our assets in the Bank of England in spite of objections from the bank, because this action was in conflict with banking principles and reflected on the bank's integrity. Fortunately, we had moved our gold and assets to other countries as part of our precautionary measures, and so there was only a small amount in our trading account which fell into the hands of the British bank robbers. The more our Ministry of Finance experts delved into the problem, however, the wider became the smiles on their faces. We had been affronted in an unethical manner and were perfectly within our rights in defending ourselves against the British plunderers. The list of our financial obligations to Britain was a long one, but those obligations had always been meticulously honoured, although nowadays this might sound strange coming from a country in Africa. There was interest and redemption of loans from the British government. Clearly, through their own action, they had prevented us from honouring these. There were loans from British banking institutions. There were remittances from rents and dividends from shares to people living in Britain. And we were forced to tell them to look to the British government for their payment, as the matter had been taken out of our hands. Our Treasury set up a trust fund into which all these amounts were paid, awaiting the day when we would be free to meet our obligations. The Ministry of Finance informed me that on the balance of payments exercise, we stood to gain in excess of £20 million per annum. And on the side of public debt obligations, we were over £100 million to the good. A most welcome windfall, thanks to Harold Wilson's vindictiveness. I'm going to jump around a bit. There is a piece where he talks about the actions of the British were ending up encouraging the Russians, and the communists were making the most of it, and the communists were blaming Rhodesia for everything, and the British were, through their actions, kind of helping the communists. But let me just mention a few other things. It continues. Then we were confronted with a vile new problem. A constant stream of subversive propaganda from Radio Zambia, enticing Rhodesians, and I'd assume black Rhodesians, to resort to violence and sabotage, to burn down factories and tobacco barns, destroy power lines, murder white farmers. What made it especially evil was the fact that Zambian broadcasting was not only subsidized by the British government, but they also provided equipment and personnel. Their director of broadcasting, for example, was seconded from the BBC. So let me just pause there. A little bit earlier in the book, in the section that I left out, there was talk about sabotage occurring in Rhodesia, burning down of forests, and various other sabotage, terrorism and stuff that was indirectly created by the British actions and the communists working together. It is quite astounding how many times the Soviet Union and Britain end up on the same side. And this is an exact example. It's not just against the Germans in World War II. Then the next thing that Smith writes about is Wilson imposing oil sanctions on Rhodesia. He does mention America. Let me just read this little piece. There are some points that are maybe worth noting. Wilson's next move was to impose oil sanctions, something which had previously been considered, but as we will see, was not well thought out. He struck a bargain with US President Johnson that in return for British support of America's Vietnam policy, Johnson would assist with the oil embargo. This was just one more excellent example of how Rhodesia was being used as a political shuttlecock by outside countries, and how the leaders of the so-called free world countries could lend themselves to corrupt decisions in order to win support for their own policies. America had no interest in or desire to do anything about Rhodesia. The British were unconcerned about Vietnam, but their leaders were dragging their countries into both these conflicts for their own selfish interests. He then goes on to say that oil sanctions wouldn't work because of the Portuguese harbors, all the South African harbors, that it was unworkable. So what happens now is quite a fascinating little twist here. With all this oil sanctions on Rhodesia, Smith then says the following. But most important was the question of Zambia, because all their exports and imports passed through Rhodesia, with the exception of an insignificant minority. Could anyone honestly believe that Rhodesia, being denied fuel in violation of internationally accepted rights, would permit fuel to traverse its transport system to supply another country, especially a hostile country, in this case Zambia? So listen to what comes out of this. But this was no problem for Wilson. There would be an airlift. RAF transport planes did a daily run from Dar es Salaam to Lusaka and managed to fly in 2,500 gallons of fuel, using, however, 4,000 gallons per day to perform the task. Into the bargain, the runways were not constructed to cater for these heavy aircraft, and so they started breaking up, and the roads out of Lusaka, taking a pounding from heavy transport, went the same way. Many Zambians started complaining. Was it all necessary, and where were they being led? So, it seems Rhodesia cut off fuel to Zambia. So the British are cutting off fuel to us, but we're still managing to get fuel, thanks to the Portuguese, through Lorenzo Marx. However, we cut off fuel to Zambia, and now it seems the Royal Air Force has to fly a long distance to East Africa to go and pick up fuel to bring to Zambia. But the fuel that they are bringing is less than the fuel that they are using. So that calculation is not working so well. So that'll give you a bit of an idea of the kind of stresses that occurred between Rhodesia and Britain, and that there was no love lost between the Rhodesians and the British over this rebellion. But the key point here is that the British military and the pilots and the chiefs of staff, all of them basically told the British politicians to go and take a hike. They are not going to get involved in a fratricidal war with their own kith and kin in Rhodesia. Too bad nobody did that in World War II and World War I. But anyhow, that is the real reason why the British government found itself unable to use force. They had all these forces that they could command, and they could use the aircraft a bit, and they could use the navy, but they couldn't get their people to come and fight and kill the very whites who had always been loyal to them. In many ways, when I think about Rhodesia and the Rhodesian Rebellion, I think to myself that maybe the best of the British Empire rebelled against Britain. That this was a rebellion by the best of the British Empire. And that these whites just stood up for themselves and stood their ground, as few as they were. But the key thing is that the idea of coming and killing the whites, the military was not going to do that. The pilots were not going to do it. The army wasn't going to do it. They weren't going to come and kill their own family. And so it shows the limitations of these mad, insane politicians who are driven by economics and diplomacy. Their real tools are economic and diplomatic, either through Jewish money or through diplomacy. And for them, it was more important to have good diplomacy with all these black countries than to worry about their own people. Britain is a country that is very much controlled by nothing more than money. And the British are out of touch with so many things. And this is why they're out of touch with America, they're out of touch with Europe. Britain is really a country with some serious economic problems. And for them, losing their empire was a disaster. And the way that they tried to maintain that empire was through this political concept called the Commonwealth of Nations, which still exists to this day. And basically, the Commonwealth is just so that the British can talk to the blacks and the Asians and try to do some diplomacy. But I don't think that it's worked that well, and that it's a desperate act by the British to hang on to their former colonies and to try and see what they can milk out of them. I think it's mostly so they can buy raw materials, like they buy oil from Nigeria, and also for them to have diplomatic access to things. But that is really the main thing for Britain. Britain has got its own real problems. And when the British Empire collapses, Britain really lacks power, and it's busy grovelling on the ground to a couple of blacks here and a couple of blacks there. Meanwhile, whites who are on the ground and able to control a piece of territory like Rhodesia, those whites are actually, despite their tiny, tiny numbers, they're actually able to pack quite a punch. And this is a very important topic that I'm going to return to, the territory that belongs to whites. Territory, physical territory that you occupy. I cannot stress enough its importance. And it should be clear to you from this exercise that just these few whites living in this country, controlling these blacks, are able to spit in the face of Britain and able to do a whole bunch of things in total rebellion and get away with it. And it's because they control the instruments of state. They control the government, they control the police, they control the army, they control the legal system. They have their hands on the levers of power, even though they are such a small group of people. And it should show you the amount of power that you have when you do that. Over and above that, you've got whites who are still good at doing various other work and jobs, etc., and they're able to control the blacks and see to it that everything runs smoothly. It's a strange system that works, and it's a system that works, and you'll see it come up time and again, that when whites rule blacks, it works very well. Whites are essentially in competition with blacks. They're essentially in competition with the leadership of the blacks. That is actually what's happening. And that is true right to this very day. Even the liberals in America and Europe and Britain and so forth are in competition with black leaders. And blacks are indirectly being led by whites. And it actually results in a better outcome for the blacks. However, the reality is that within the context of race, it is not our purpose to be here to assist the blacks. We need to be looking out for ourselves. And I have my own thoughts on those matters. But the key point here that I just want to emphasize as I wind up is that the real reason the British could not get an invasion of Rhodesia going, despite it being the legal thing, the valid thing, was that the military, especially the top brass, told them they are not going to go and kill their kith and kin, especially since those kith and kin had fought in battle with them and been with them in every place where they had problems. Smith didn't mention in his memoirs Malaysia. The Rhodesian army and our forces fought a lot in Malaysia, where the British took a big beating. So the British had these people that were totally and utterly dedicated and loyal to Britain. And now the politician on a dime says, go and invade them. And the military are saying, no, this is not happening. We're not going to kill those people. Because they knew them personally and they knew their loyalty. And so apart from a couple of Rhodesian military officers who went to Gibbs and swore loyalty to Britain, the rest of the Rhodesians were all behind Ian Smith. Too bad Ian Smith couldn't have been the Prime Minister of Britain, hey? Wouldn't that have been a better thing? But there is a very important conclusion out of this for the rest of you in America, in Europe, even in Britain itself, even in Australia, etc. And it is this, that the politicians of today, the liberal politicians, may be a bunch of madmen driven by Jewish money and business and stupid diplomacy for junk reasons. And they may be wildly insane with their desire to destroy white people so that they can grovel on the ground at the feet of Jews, blacks, and everybody else. However, my view has been that if there is anybody in the Western world who have higher values than these low-down dogs known as politicians, it is the military. Napoleon once said that the army is the nobility of France. And I think in the Western world, despite all the values going downwards, you will find time and again that especially in the military and to a certain extent in the police and even in the intelligence services, including even the CIA, I must tell you that I don't believe that the military and the police and the intelligence services will set out to kill the whites of the Western world if the mad, insane Jews, liberals and communist scum try to get them to. Probably the closest to that was the piece of shit Bill Clinton when he had them kill those Christians and burn them to death. And now I forget the name of those Christians, but I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. Those Christians who were burned to death in their camp during the time of Clinton. But I think that on the whole, the military will never go after the common whites in the USA or Britain or Europe or Australia. That you will find that the military types are different and they have got a much different view of life, and they are probably the closest thing that we have to some kind of organization that has got some kind of noble values, even if it's not as noble as it used to be. But I firmly believe that the military people are not to be feared. As long as you are not busy burning down the country yourself and killing people, you have nothing to fear from the military in either the USA or elsewhere. And I'm well aware of the FEMA camps, and I'm well aware for many years of the talk of guillotines and cutting people's heads off and FEMA camps and all that. But I think that when push comes to shove, the military will never, ever allow that. As insane as the Jews and the politicians are, as insane as the liberals and the leftist radicals are, I don't see that the military will allow the people to be killed, and that includes the whites. And in my own discussions in America and Canada from my trips there and also just my contacts over the years, I must tell you that I'm quite convinced that the most honorable part of Western civilization that remains is the military. Even as its standards are going down, it's still the most honorable thing that's left. And in fact, I was doing a lot of reading recently, and among the reading that I was doing, I came across a story about a general in America who was talking about how the politicians are the enemy, and how many generals in America in the 50s, late 50s and early 60s were against the politicians, and they were even hinting at the idea of a coup d'etat, they were hinting of doing other things. And John Birch Society people were being given publicity by generals in the USA. There were generals who saw an enemy within, and they were very concerned by it. I must tell you that I'm quite convinced military people are the last piece of the Western world that we can turn to. And I will always suggest to you, always be friendly to military people, be friendly to police, be friendly to intelligence and ex-intelligence people, and talk to them as white to white, and deal with them directly. Yes, there are going to be spies, there are going to be all kinds of things, but I really think that you're going to find that in the Western society, as much as it's been corrupted, the last thing that's left that is going to be useful are the military people. It is those kinds of people who have experience with the way the world really is. It is them who are always going to have a soft spot for the white patriot. And Adolf Hitler himself also ran into this thing and saw the value in it. So as much as you think that the Jews want us killed, I want to tell you, I don't think that when push comes to shove, that the military will actually go out there and follow the orders of communists and other shitbags if they try to just go and kill whites. They will not do that easily. That is the place where the final bit of resistance will come from. And so here are these British politicians dealing with an open rebellion by whites, and the military are telling them, well, we're not going to go and invade those people, and we're not going to go and kill them. End of story. It's a thing we refuse to do. And those politicians are absolutely dumbfounded. For once, they've got the military telling them no. And I want to tell you that the military, I have the respect for the military people, that even when they are liberal, they will still be more sane than these other freaks that are in parliaments, etc. So there you have it. The story, the inside story of why Britain didn't invade Rhodesia. I also want to just discuss the topic of secession a little bit, because the Rhodesian Rebellion also has a bit of an element in it that ties up to secession. Secession in South Africa, for example, is theoretically legal in the Constitution. The Constitution that the whites negotiated with the blacks allows for secession. But of course, in the case of the United States, they also had the ability to secede. And the South had every right to secede. But the problem was that when the South decided to secede, the North decided to break the constitutional rules and force unity at gunpoint over the dead bodies of hundreds of thousands of men. In fact, I was reading that a historian says that the accepted figure of 620,000 dead in the American Civil War is actually wrong, and that the real death toll was 21% higher at 750,000 dead. So the problem with power is that even if you're allowed to secede legally and constitutionally, that in actual fact, this might not be allowed because whoever it is that you are seceding from might decide that they don't want it to happen. Now, in the case of South Africa, there are currently people busy working on secession. A guy by the name of Hein Marx is busy with this. And he's already got 360,000 whites and non-whites who are busy with an attempt of secession in the Cape. And I think they need to get to about 2 million in order to pull it off. So this is the largest number of people that have been counted in South Africa who are working towards secession that will be legal. and it's multiracial, but whites are the real driving force in actual fact. But a question I have is whether the South African government would ever allow it. I don't believe they will. I think they'll do all kinds of things to prevent anybody from seceding from South Africa. But anyhow, it's still a good exercise, and we'll have to see how it plays out. And there are whites in America talking about secession as well. And again, the same thing is there. Even if you follow the processes, what happens at the end? And I personally think that the Rhodesian lesson is going to apply. And I think that what you will find is that when you secede, regardless of where you are, in which country, whether it's in Europe or North America or wherever, there are even people in Canada talking about secession. And in fact, one of the best examples I've come across of people who wanted to secede were the French in Quebec. And the French had two different elections, one in the 1970s, one in the 1990s. And in both of those elections, French people told me they actually won. They got a majority of the vote. However, the Canadian government came in and they rigged the thing, and it was rigged so that these people couldn't break away. So as much as the French wanted to break away, they couldn't, even when they'd followed the processes. So my view is that when it comes to having rules, and when it comes to having legal processes to break away from a country, that in actual fact, it's a 90% chance or 99% chance it won't be allowed. And that at the end of the day, you need to have weapons. If you want to be free, you gotta have weapons. Because if you want to be free, the power that rules over you will come to stop you. And I think that this is very likely everywhere. You can even see it in Europe in the breakup of Yugoslavia when the Croatians decided to break away. Same thing. The moment the Croatians want to break away, it ends up in a bloody war. And the war is when you succeed. And if you are unable to fight a war, you fail, you lose everything. And in the case of Rhodesia, Rhodesia lasted for a time because they had physical power and, above all, military power. So one thing that I try to tell whites everywhere, because I believe this is totally true, is make sure you are armed. Whatever political moves you're going to make on whichever continent, if you are trying to save yourself from being inundated with non-whites, etc., that I really believe that the powers that be will cheat you, and they'll cheat you even if you are legally allowed to do something. You've got to have weapons. You have got to have that to back up your political willpower. It's the way history works. When it comes to raw power, those with power will cheat you in an instant, and you've got to be able to defend yourself. Now, personally, I must tell you that I also think that we whites need new, what you could call pariah states like Rhodesia. That I think in the future, that if whites are serious, that we are going to have to do Rhodesia types of things. We are going to have to be willing, at a point when we've made up our minds, we're going to have to do the wild thing. We're going to have to declare UDI. We're going to have to openly state that we're going to do this whether you like it or not. I think that this risky type of politics, which so many from Rhodesia nowadays like to blame Ian Smith for, I really think that whites in the future are going to have to do these things as we try to save ourselves from multiracial globalist type of states. If we get to the point where we want to break away, that you're going to have to do your secession, follow the legal path, and make sure you seize it physically. And there is risk involved. Risk is a part of life. And when it comes to real power, real things, risk is there. You will never be able to achieve anything great if you're not willing to take risks. Things do not just fall into your lap, especially when it comes to countries, ruling yourself, freedom, etc. These things do not fall into your lap. And so you're going to need bolder kinds of leaders and politicians who at a point will say, you know what, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take our chances. We're going to take our risks. Let the chips fall where they may, and off we go. I really think you cannot avoid that. You will find that exists in the history of our race, in the history of the world. It is the way it is. And to do things like have your own nation, this is not for sissies. You can't be free if you're a coward. The only people who ever get to be free are the bold and the strong and the courageous. And if you aren't that kind of person, you're not going to be free. On some occasions, people may take risks and they can pull it off with little or no bloodshed, but you must know that there are possibilities of these things. And we have to be bolder and more determined in the future. And I think that some of Rhodesia's lessons are there and they can help a bit. And I will reiterate that I do believe, regardless of the people who now say it was all wrong and Ian Smith did wrong, etc., etc., and there are Rhodesians who are saying it more and more, but you will find that in history, the bold man, the man with courage, the man with determination, he has got to take big risks. And just like Ian Smith calculated and said, okay, I don't think the British are going to invade us because I've got this information, let's go for it. And everybody is not really sure if this thing can work, but he's basing it on some information that he's got that he trusts and he thinks the risk is worth taking. Risks and taking of risks, calculating of risks, this is important in life. It is very important in warfare, and it's very important just in all the major things. You will find that the weak, the pathetic, the cowardly, things don't fall in their laps. At least not for whites who are of that nature. Maybe others get things for free, but whites definitely don't. So don't get hung up on legal stuff and rules. Understand that ultimately the final rule is that might is right. Doesn't matter what's in the US Constitution, it's who's got the most firepower. That's what determined what is right for America. And you'll see that again in other places. And I'm convinced it'll happen even in South Africa. So one of the things is boldness. Think of boldness, think of determination, and then many things are possible. Because you will find that our race, our people, this is what we did in the past. We've always been bold, we've taken risks, many times paid the price dearly with bloodshed, but we are a dynamic people and we live in the real world. And this is how the real world works. And our pagan ancestors were totally at ease with this kind of thing. So just a few thoughts for you on the matter of secession, breakaway, and the future. And also to show you that Ian Smith was no traitor. And it was a lot of cunning thinking by these Rhodesians who knew the British backwards because they'd been loyal to Britain and dealt with Britain for so long. And when Britain decided to throw them to the wolves, they were in a position where they were able to rebel and to at least stand up for themselves for a period of time. So just a small group of whites who showed Britain the finger and got away with it. And I personally think it was a good thing that we fought for all those years, that we at least had some semblance of our own rule for ourselves and we defended ourselves. I personally have no problem with what we did. There are those who sit and they cry about it afterwards, but I don't really think that it was such a disaster. I think that people did what they could. The odds were against them. We were under sanctions. We had virtually everybody against us except for Portugal and South Africa and the French and some other assistants in Europe. And other than that, I think we did okay. Whereas the blacks had almost unlimited support from Russia and China. So here are the communists and they see, well, nobody is going to help these whites. So the major countries aren't going to help the whites. This is our chance. Let's go for it. And they just hammer away, and they and all the blacks of Africa hammer away. Even so, it takes them 14 years. Even so, it takes all of Africa plus Russia plus China. It still takes them 14 years to collapse a country run by 250,000 whites who control blacks who outnumber them 20 to 1. So I personally don't think we did half bad. And the same is true for the whites of South Africa and for the Portuguese. But we're going to return to other topics related to this. I just wanted to make it clear why the British government was unable to invade Rhodesia. And I think all of this will show you that there was genuine animosity in the end between Britain and Rhodesia. And the Rhodesians took some big chances. In all major things in life, you take big risks. Hitler took risks. Everybody who tries to achieve something takes a risk. And if the risk is a life and death risk and it can go wrong, people can be killed, things can go wrong, and yeah, you'll get the crybabies who cry about it afterwards. But the reality is, it's history, it's water under the bridge. And my own view of a lot of things these days is that no effort is ever really wasted. Even if people die, I no longer see it as such a negative. To me, any experiment, anything that you do where you try something, you are getting a chance to attempt something that's not been done before. If you win, great. And if you lose, well, it's documented and so many other whites can learn from it. There's always something that you can learn from it. I don't think that history is wasted at all. Even death, even war and death, I don't think that any of this is actually a waste. If you're willing to stand up for something like our ancestors did, you will find that there are many opportunities in life. Get away from weak thinking, Jewish thinking, liberal thinking, and start hardening yourself and looking towards a future that's harder. And then you will see that there are many opportunities for us. We are a people who come from a long, long history of struggle. And I've hardly even done anything about our ancient history. But our history is a history of struggle. And it's worked for us in the past. We've been much worse off than we are now. And if we had to sit down and struggle in this age of modern technology, I think there are magical and amazing things that we can still do. So don't give up on anything. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-sharp.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.